Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Hello and welcome to a brand new Arsblog Arscast right here on arsblog.com. How are you? I hope you're well. It's interlull week, so there's not much going on from an Arsenal point of view. That's why a podcast is more important than ever. And we do have a podcast for you today. How do I know? Well, because I'm recording it. And how do you know there's a podcast? Well, because you've downloaded it and you're listening to it. I'm on Acast. Or iTunes. Oh, does iTunes? iTunes doesn't even exist anymore, apparently. They've done away with it in the new Mac OS update. iTunes is no longer iTunes. They've split it into a number of different apps. I think there's a podcast app, a music app, and a... What the fuck else was there on iTunes apart from podcasts and music? Movies? Was there, like, films and shit? I don't know. Maybe they've done that too, but however it is that you're listening to this podcast, whether it's in, you know, iTunes or not iTunes or YouTube or Spotify or Acast or Pocket Cast or Cast Monkey or Pod Glooper or Cast Jizz or Ear Sounds or whatever fucking app you use, thank you for being here. Thank you for listening. And hopefully we can provide you with some entertainment to get you through this tedious, dull, lifeless, limp, lifeless interlull. That's what it is. Today I was we're doing some cleaning up around the house and throwing a lot of stuff out. You know, one of those periodic things where you go, we've got to throw like crap out, stuff that's been in boxes for years and years and years. Anyway, I came across a notebook around the time that I started Arsblog. And it was full of other Arsenal websites. I'm sure I've told this story before, but the very first iteration of Arsblog was, it was a little more niche. It was a little more niche than that. The first website I started, the first Arsenal website, was actually called The Church of Bob, which operated under the premise that Robert Pires was a kind of religious slash cult leader and everybody was enthralled to Robert Pires. And it was, you know, a kind of a one gag thing that didn't go much beyond one gag. And, you know, it was hard to get beyond that one gag and do anything on a consistent basis with it. And then afterwards, I came up with the idea of Arsblog, which was, you know, a little more broad, gives you a bit more scope to talk about stuff. But anyway, around the time that I was setting all that up, I did a list of all the various Arsenal websites that were around in 2001, 2002. And I think this was late 2001 when I put this list together. I put it up on Twitter, and man, there's such a lot of Arsenal websites. There's some of the bigger ones like Sky Sports is there, Reuters, This Is London, which became the Evening Standard, of course, Football 365, SoccerNet, The Mirror, ITV Sport. But there was like all the stuff like Arsenal World, at AFC, Steve Gleaver's website, and you might remember he used to do like match day IRC channels, if you have any idea what that was, but ArsWeb, Ars Online, Up the Arse, GunnerNet, and then weird stuff like weird pages that people would do, like, so Jacko's page, I don't know who Jacko is, Kerry's AFC page, Mike the Austrian Gunner, Jason Lim's page. There are all these strange ones out there. Vlad's page. Arsenal Experience, Pete's AFC page. There was Peter's Tony Adams page, Anthony's Absolute Arsenal. Just a rake of Arsenal websites. There were so many of them around back then. I don't think there are quite as many now. I mean, I know there's loads of, you know, Facebook groups, and there are loads of Arsenal podcasts, and there are, you know, there used to be a lot of Arsenal blogs, a whole load of Arsenal blogs out there. You could read loads of them, but now there aren't too many of them that are updating on a regular basis. But this was in the early days of the internet. If you want to check out the websites, you can look at it on my Twitter. It's twitter.com/arsblog. And wow, I mean, there were just so many of them out there. It was a bit of a throwback. Some I'm sure people will remember. And, you know, in those formative years of the internet, they kind of stick in your memory a bit, the pages and the websites that you used to visit. But there was just so much out there from an Arsenal point of view. And look, here we are, whatever it is, coming up on, what year is it? It's 2019. So 2020... it's going to be 18 years of Arsblog in 2020, so that will tell you a lot has come and gone in that space of time. Anyway, there's a little ramble down memory lane for you. Now, though, let's get on with the show and let's have some interlol Arsenal chat. Joining me to discuss Unai Emery and getting a kind of Spanish perspective on him, it's Alex Kirkland, who is the producer of the Spanish Football Podcast, but he's a journalist based in Madrid and, of course, an Arsenal fan. He's somebody who knows Unai Emery well from his time working in Spain. Alex, how are you?
Hello, Andrew. How are you doing?
Very good, thanks. Glad to have you on the show. And I want to talk to you a bit about Unai Emery to start with. We might touch on Arsenal's league form and some of the tactical and system issues that have affected that during the course of this season and maybe last season as well. But one of the big positives from an Arsenal fan's point of view, and I'm sure you'd agree, is that the emergence of some of the young talent at the club, and everyone knows the names, but Joe Willock, Bukayo Saka, Reece Nelson, Gabriel Martinelli, even Matteo Guendouzi to a certain extent, has been one of the real positives about this season, and some of the performances in the cup competitions have been thoroughly enjoyable. I'm just sort of curious as to what Emery's record is like with young players at other clubs, because I feel like many managers, if they have the option between a young, inexperienced player and an experienced player who they can more or less count on, they'll generally all plump for the experienced player they can count on. This season, Arsenal have taken away some of those experienced players in the shape of Iwobi, Mkhitaryan in particular, when we're talking about young players that come through to play in the front three or further up the field. So Emery hasn't had a great deal of choice in terms of the players that he's been able to use in those positions. So it is a positive, but how does it tally up with some of his previous clubs like Valencia and Sevilla in particular?
I feel like it's not his preference. I think what we've seen this season has been a necessity more than anything. I think we saw last season, for example, when he had the choice, when he had the option, he preferred to go with the experience, someone like Mkhitaryan, for example. Mm. And I think if you look back at his time at Sevilla and at Valencia as well, I mean, his reputation here in general is as quite a conservative coach,
yeah,
as kind of a safety first kind of coach. And actually, I mean, you'll hear people being a lot more critical than that. I remember when he was appointed as Arsenal coach, and I was, you know, once I got over the initial kind of surprise and shock, like all of us, I was trying to kind of, you know, talk myself into the idea. And I remember talking to a colleague of mine here who's the correspondent for L'Equipe. He's a French journalist. And I asked him, oh, what do you think about Emery? You know, do you think he could be a good fit for Arsenal? And the word he used to describe him is not very flattering, actually. And he was basically saying that he was a bit of a coward, a bit of a negative coach, a coach who is very much safety first. And that's what he'll revert to, you know, in kind of difficult times. And I think there is something in that. Like, I can't, when I think back to his Sevilla team and the Valencia team before that, I don't think there are too many cases that you can point to of him going for a young player out of choice and really kind of sticking with it. I think it's, if he has to, he'll do it. But I definitely don't feel like It's a preference of his, and I certainly don't feel like it's kind of a hallmark or a trademark of his kind of style or his kind of coaching ideas.
Yeah, it's quite interesting though, isn't it? Because I read this week Matteo Guendouzi, he's away on international duties with the French under 21s, and he is absolutely full of praise for Emery. He says he's someone who's taught me a lot on and off the pitch. I want to repay that trust. He gave me the opportunity at the highest level. And that was kind of a surprise to see him come through last season as quickly as he did when he signed. Because there was a rumour that Arsenal were after a youngster from PSG. Was it Yassine Adli?
Yeah.
Similar kind of profile of player. Guendouzi maybe a little more advanced in terms of his development and certainly a couple of years older. But the way that Guendouzi was integrated straight away into the first team, you know, I'm not saying it makes a lie of what you're saying, but it's sort of at odds a little bit with that because he was this young, inexperienced guy, obviously full of enthusiasm and determination and everything else. But, you know, in the opening game of the season against Manchester City, there he was, and he kind of kept his place throughout most of the season. So, you know, do you think perhaps that player and his use of that player has maybe opened his mind a little bit?
Guendouzi is interesting, and I do wonder if he is a bit of a special case. Now, whether it's because he just really, really likes him as a player, or whether it's because he's not so keen on the alternatives, or maybe it's a bit of both. I'm not quite sure. You know, you guys have talked on the podcast about Torreira and the way that it seems that Emery doesn't quite like Torreira or doesn't quite know how to use him. So maybe it's a little bit of both. Maybe it's that he sees something in Guendouzi, but also it's looking at the other options there and feeling that they've been a little bit lacking. And then, you know, Guendouzi, he's sort of seized the opportunity. And certainly, I mean, this year, I think he's been brilliant, and you basically can't leave him out because of how important he's become.
I wonder, is it perhaps a little bit of a test from the Arsenal hierarchy as well, in the sense that they've obviously, and you can hear Edu has talked about it, Mertesacker has talked about it, Raul Senyehi has talked about it, Vinay, the job share guy with Raul, whose job escapes me at this moment. He's the MD, or the, you know, he looks after the business side of the club. But and if he's listening, I apologize for not getting your job right. But, you know, he talked very, very explicitly more than once, and quite recently on a trip to India, I think, as well, where the importance of the academy was crucial to the club because, A, it can save you money in the transfer market, and that, I think, is something we can all identify as something Arsenal want to do, but also it can generate you money that, you know, players who come through and play for a while and maybe don't make the grade, they're much more valuable when you go to sell them because they've got 50 or 70 or even 100 Premier League games under their belt. And I do wonder if this strategy of taking away the likes of Mkhitaryan and Iwobi, and maybe even to a lesser extent Mesut Ozil, depending on what's happening there, is the club kind of pushing him out of his comfort zone to see if he's the right man to carry out that strategy?
But it makes me feel like Emery is maybe in that case a bit of a square peg in a round hole, because you hear everything that the club say about the kind of team they want to be, the style that they want, all of that, and then I think you look at Emery, and it seems to me that there's a bit of a there's a clash there. Like, he doesn't, his style and everything that we know about him doesn't, to me, necessarily fit everything that the clubs say they want their coach to be, and actually even that Emery kind of says that he wants to be, because sometimes I feel like the things that he says about what he wants to see from his team aren't really reflected in what we actually see. So yeah, I think that's true, but to be honest, it kind of makes me think that they're trying to make him be the kind of coach that they want, when maybe that's not really the coach that he is.
Yeah, they might have to find that coach somewhere else. Yeah, look, it is very interesting. And I think when you talk about the things that he says and the things that we see being slightly diverse, if you like, you know, what he says about the game and controlling the game and being attacking. And then you look at some of the performances and it's hard to understand, well, if that's your philosophy, are you carrying it out that badly? You know, but communication, I think, and we spoke about this a few weeks ago, communication has kind of been a thing with Emery throughout his career. And it's not necessarily just tied to the fact that English is a second language, or, you know, he had issues in France as well, where perhaps I think they might be a little more, what's the word I want to use here? A little more precious about the language than people are in England. But even in Spanish, even in his native tongue, there are issues with the way that he communicates.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the jobs that I used to do out here was translating pre and post match press conferences into English for a client in the UK, and a colleague of mine and I used to joke about who would have to do the Emery press conferences at Sevilla, because you didn't want that job, because he'd get asked a question and he would go on and on and on and around in circles. And it's not that it didn't make sense, of course it did, you know, but it's just that there wasn't a lot of, you know, there'd be sort of some buzzwords in there and there'd be some ideas in there that you could kind of, you could see what he was saying, but it never quite came together. And it certainly wasn't kind of clear and concise. You know, he'd answer a question, he'd take 2 minutes answering a question, when, you know, a lot of coaches, you know, 30 seconds max and you're done. So it's not just a language thing, and it's not just a problem with his English, although I think that is a problem as well. He's like it in Spanish as well. Now, I can't believe that he's like that with the players. I mean, I really hope he's not like that with the players. It might well be different out on the training ground and behind closed doors, but that's certainly the way that he was with the press, which is weird because, you know, being a good communicator, you feel like it's so fundamental to being a good coach. Like, it's one of the most important things.
Yeah.
And it's just, it's a funny one. But then he's, you know, he's an interesting character, isn't he? He's kind of like, I think it feeds into his reputation here. He's very highly regarded in Spain. He's highly rated, you know, in terms of active Spanish coaches at the moment. It's only Pep who has a better CV in terms of trophies won. And there's no doubt that, you know, whenever the time comes for him to leave Arsenal, there would be big jobs for him here in Spain. You know, whenever the Spain job comes up next, for example, Emery would be a candidate for sure. When Simeone eventually leaves Atleti, whenever that may be, he would be talked about as well for that because of his CV. But he's not necessarily kind of loved here, I guess, because he's not exactly a lovable character. There's a little bit of kind of, there's a distance there, you know, there's a slight remoteness there.
He's hard to connect to. Like, you know, it's difficult to get a read on his personality, because I remember reading an interview with him last season, and obviously his first season in England, and anybody who's gone to live in a different country will understand, you know, particularly as an adult, you know, they'll understand the difficulty of learning a new language and how hard it is to speak a new language, particularly in public. And I think that's one of the things that, you know, I have to take my hat off to Emery, whether it was the right thing to do or not, whether he might have been better working with a translator for a little while or not. You know, he sat down on the very first day he arrived at Arsenal and he tried to speak English. And I think that's something, you know, to be admired.
Yeah, it's really brave. It's really brave and quite impressive, I think.
Because you're always like worried about, am I going to say, you know, the wrong thing? Am I going to pronounce the word wrong? Am I going to use the wrong word? Am I just going to run out of words? Just not going to be able to think of how to say what it is that I want to say? It's all quite terrifying. You know, even if, you know, I remember when I first moved to Spain and you used to, oh God, I have to go and like go to the you know, the electric shop or whatever, and I've got to talk to them about my electric bill, and it's terrifying just talking to somebody behind the counter, let alone a room full of journalists or the whole world on TV. So from that point of view, I've got a great deal of admiration for him, but it's difficult to get a read on his personality. And I was going back to that interview that he did with El Mundo, and it was much more eloquent and much more concise. Now, whether that was down to some judicious editing on their part, I don't know. But you got a better sense of him from that interview. But, you know, he isn't an easy guy to connect with, particularly as we're still, I think, you know, maybe 18 months in now, to close to 18 months into his time at Arsenal, trying to properly understand what it is that he wants his team to do on the pitch. And I think the two things, you know, they feed off each other. You know, the lack of ability to connect with him as a person is exacerbated by the lack of connection with his football, if that makes sense.
And also the communication thing, I mean, it hasn't got better. I don't think he's maybe his English is a little bit more expansive and there's more vocabulary there, but in terms of understanding exactly what he's getting at, I don't feel like it's any easier to understand now than it was a year ago, particularly. Now I've spoken to people who know him personally and know him quite well, and they say that in person he is a really kind of engaging, passionate, interesting guy, but that doesn't always come across in the public persona. And there's not necessarily anything wrong with that, because I think everyone who's like a public figure has kind of a public and a private persona. But I don't think it helps, like I say, when communication is such a key part of what you do. I really don't think it's helpful. And in addition, like, it would be one thing if what was happening on the pitch was really clear, but his explanations off it were unclear. Maybe that would be okay. But I feel like there's a lack of clarity on the pitch as well. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
None of it's clear. Like, what we're seeing on the pitch isn't clear, and what we're hearing from him isn't, and doesn't match up either. So there's there's nowhere that you can really get a proper message from of what it's all about and what he's trying to do.
Yeah. What do you make of what's happening on the pitch? Because obviously he's a coach who has won things. Everyone knows about the three Europa Leagues, and you know, the trophies that he's won there are you know, you can't take that away from him. But again, going back to what happened with Sevilla, what happened with Valencia when he was the coach there, in terms of like a consistency of league position and performance, you know, was he or has he been the kind of coach who has demonstrated on a consistent basis that he can get his team to play, I don't mean attacking football or exciting football or whatever, but a kind of football with consistency, whether you like it or you don't like it, you know, is it the same from, you know, one game to the next, or was he always this kind of chameleonic coach whose teams look like they were lurching from one thing to the next?
I feel like at Sevilla there was more of a clear idea of what he wanted the team to do, and I feel like that his Sevilla team were kind of recognisable as having a style. And at Valencia as well, I mean, I think people forget a little bit because it's obviously a little bit longer ago, but at Valencia he did an amazing job because he got them to finish third, and it was a time when they were a complete mess off the pitch. He was losing his best players every season, and he did really, really well there. Funny enough, the Valencia fans now can't stand him. In fact, I was at Mestalla last year for a game when Valencia played Getafe, and Emery was there as well. Some of his family still live in Valencia, and I think he was taking a look at a player as well. And when they showed Emery on the big screen at Mestalla, it was a chorus of whistles. Most of that is down to one specific incident when he was back there with Sevilla and he celebrated like crazy a last minute Sevilla goal. So it's partly that. It's not only, you know, what he did as Valencia coach, and also the fans there are incredibly demanding. But to go back to it, no, I feel like Sevilla did have a much clearer idea, and there was a real kind of energy to them, and they did really kind of go at teams. It wasn't always plain sailing at Sevilla. You know, they famously went an entire league season without winning an away game, which is not ideal.
No.
But generally, yeah, I feel like there was more of a clarity there. Then, you know, PSG, I can't really speak to because I didn't see as much of his PSG, and I feel like it's such a weird situation anyway. But at Arsenal, I just feel like I'm not any closer to having an idea of what he wants the team to be.
Were you,
you know, going into this season, I really wanted to be positive going into this season, because I think, like a lot of Arsenal fans, I was really excited about the business we did at the end of the window, and I wanted to kind of be upbeat and positive and say, oh, let's see what we can do this year, even though the end of last season was just so horrific and kind of deflating and disappointing. But I just don't see an improvement, and I don't see a plan.
Yeah,
and people will say we're third in the table and we've only lost one game, and that's true. I know. You can't argue with that. But I want to see something to kind of hang on to as some sort of progression that's being made, and it's just not. I don't think it's there.
I was going to ask you, you know, because last season we had you have all the various caveats, you know, it's his first season, players injured, and some of the reasons are perfectly okay to sort of provide some mitigation for the way we performed last season. But were you, and I know I was, particularly after the summer that we had and after the way that he was backed, I was critical of the club for not backing him more in January, because I think if they had, potentially Arsenal would be playing Champions League football this season. But in the summer, you can't say that he wasn't backed in the transfer market, you know, in a pretty big and comprehensive way. So were you expecting, I know it's only eight games, it's a long season, blah, 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 but I was expecting to see something just a little more cohesive by now, and I'm not, and that provides me with concerns that some people don't share. Some people are just looking at the table and saying we're in a decent position given everything else that's going on around us, and we can kick on from there. But my underlying sort of concern is the way that we're playing and not seeing that progression based on what we did in the transfer market.
I don't think there are any excuses this season. Really. And in fact, I think there's a huge opportunity there. I mean, just as there was last season, to be honest. You know, you've got United are a complete mess. Spurs are falling apart. Chelsea have got a totally unproven coach, although it does kind of annoy me, and I hate to say it, but the way that Chelsea seem to be kind of enjoying themselves at the moment in terms of having a club legend as coach and relying on young players, I don't think they're they're not a perfect team by any means, but I think there's a lot for them to enjoy about how they've been playing. But yeah, I just feel like there is such an opportunity this season, just as there was last year, and we blew it. And look, we might well still finish in the top four. We could easily finish in the top four. I don't rule that out at all. But like I say, I just want to see something that tells me there's like a direction that we're heading in, and we're not just gonna end up in the top four through kind of inertia and the failings of others. And especially, like, I mean, the last few league games, the Europa League and the Cup, I kind of put to one side, and I don't dismiss them, but I just feel like it's a different thing altogether. But the last few league games, starting with the Watford second half, and then Villa and United and Bournemouth, I don't know, they've really, that run of league games has really made me think, I don't know. I don't want to be, kind of trigger happy, and I don't want to be overly negative either, but they have really made me question whether he's the right man or not. But like I say, I mean, we might well still finish top four, and maybe that was all his role was ever supposed to be, get us back into the top four, and then maybe he goes and someone else comes in and we start again. But I want to have a bit of fun along the way, and like these last few games for me, they haven't been fun, like, at all, really.
No, no.
And I hate to say that about watching Arsenal, but it is important. I want to have fun watching my team.
Yeah, I know what you mean. I was curious. I was watching I don't know if you've seen it yet, but the Ian Wright interview with Dennis Bergkamp.
I haven't yet. No,
it's absolutely brilliant. You know, how could it not be, obviously? But there's a really interesting bit when Wrighty is asking him, how did the move to Arsenal come about? What was going on? And Dennis, was saying about he'd been in Italy for 2 years. His agent was talking to the club, and it was all, we're not quite sure what way it's going to go. So he was open to the move, but he was also talking about football in Italy and how it's very much your job, how it's 9 to 5. You've either got to get 3 points. If you don't get 3 points, you got to get 1 point. And if you don't get 1 point, it's a disaster and everything else. And he said, I wanted to sort of reconnect with what football is supposed to be about. And it's supposed to be a game. And you're supposed to have fun. And, we can rationalize that, okay, results are the most important thing. Of course, we can all see that in that box. But also, I think there is something to what he was saying and what you're saying And having fun kind of goes hand in hand with performances. And if you're playing well, you're more likely to have fun. And if you're having fun, you're playing well. And if you're playing well, you're more likely to get results. You know, it's not just, it's not a binary thing, is it? That you don't just have to have fun. You can still get results and play well.
Well, and also, I would maybe be willing to sacrifice some of the fun, not all of the fun, but some of the fun, if you were watching kind of a ruthlessly efficient team that was grinding out results and it wasn't a lot of fun, but you could really see what the idea was. You know, look at, I don't know, look at Atletico Madrid, for example, okay?
Yeah.
In their last five games in all competitions, Atleti haven't conceded a single goal. They've had five clean sheets in a row. Now, Atleti aren't always fun to watch. In fact, quite frequently they're not fun to watch. But at least there you can look at that and see, well, something is working. Okay, they're not scoring enough goals. That's also true. But something there is working. It's not a kind of a dysfunctional team, you know. But I don't feel like we're getting that either. So I feel like, do you know what I mean? I'm willing to trade off to a certain extent if I feel like I'm getting something in return for that trade off. But I don't feel like I'm even getting that. I feel like I'm not having a lot of fun, and the team are still kind of a bit all over the place, and sometimes just about winning games and sometimes just about not winning games. But do you know what I mean? So I'm not sure what the upside is.
We've kind of fallen between two stools in a way. Yeah, I know what you mean. Well, look, we'll see what the rest of this season brings and whether Emery can provide an improvement in performances and the fun level. And I think if he does, then, you know, the chances of us winning games increases, because, you know, we've kind of ground our way to all our Premier League wins have been by a single goal this season. So there is definitely room for improvement there. Before we go, let's just talk a little bit about Dani Ceballos. And he is on international duty away with Spain at the moment. He might not play at the weekend because of a little hamstring strain, but is expected to be in the team or available for Tuesday's game, which is against Sweden, I think. He seems to be enjoying life in North London. From what he said while he was away with Spain, he seems like a happy guy at Arsenal.
Yeah, he really is. In fact, I was listening to him talk on the radio this morning, and he was saying exactly that. He was kind of he was singing the praises of Emery, actually, to be fair, which it's kind of interesting, because I don't think that Ceballos is necessarily totally an Emery-type player. Although, you know, I also think whenever you hear players talking about almost anything, you have to take it with such a massive pinch of salt, because, you know, they're on media duty. They know that everybody's listening, and they very rarely speak, I think, the truth. But no, he does seem very, very, very happy. I mean, he hasn't played quite as much as I thought that he might, or maybe that he should. I think someone did a study and he's played, I think it's 57% of the minutes that he could have played for Arsenal this season. So just over half.
Yeah, but he's the only guy to have featured in all 11 games. He's the only player.
Yeah.
So yeah, I mean, minutes-wise is, another thing. But,
well, it's also, you know, he's playing a lot more, and he made this point, he's playing an awful lot more than he was for Real Madrid. And he does seem to be enjoying himself. I was so excited when we signed him, because I'd seen enough of him to know what a gifted player that he is. I wasn't totally sure exactly how he'd take to the Premier League. He talked about that as well this week, talking about how the kind of the physical challenges of the Premier League and the way that he feels that he needs to kind of adapt to that. But I actually think he's handled that pretty well. And I think part of that is because although he is a really kind of technical, creative player, he's also got that little bit of niggle. Do you know what I mean? He's got that little bit of nastiness in his game. And I think that really helps. I think he quite enjoys that. Even if he's not the biggest, strongest, most physical player, I think he does actually quite relish that challenge. There've been a couple of moments, you know, what was the game where we scored, the Aubameyang scored a goal, and it came because Ceballos had won the ball back, and Ceballos went and celebrated as if he'd scored himself, you know, stuff like that.
Yeah.
I've really, really loved seeing. So yeah, I think he's enjoying himself a lot. And I think his future, to be honest, depends almost entirely on what happens in terms of the Real Madrid managerial situation.
Yeah, he doesn't get on with Zidane, and Zidane isn't getting on particularly well with Real Madrid at the moment. But
no, even though they're top of the league.
Yeah, it's we're in a weird world.
Yeah, it has been a strange one. But no, as long as Zidane is in charge of Madrid, Ceballos will not come back. If there's a change of coach, then you know, I think the kind of the lure of Real Madrid for any Spanish player is so great that with a change of coach, I think he probably would want to come back and prove himself. So it kind of depends on what happens with Madrid this season.
Well, look, I obviously hope they keep Zidane. I hope Ceballos plays to a particularly high level with us. There's a lot of talk, and it's very, very early, of course, about, you know, making the deal permanent and him being open to that and Arsenal being open to it. But, you know, there's a long season to come and opinions on players change within a couple of weeks. So, you know, what people think of Ceballos now and what people think of Ceballos in 3, 4, 6 months' time might be very different things. But obviously, I hope he kicks on, because I think he's got qualities, I think, that really suit the Premier League. One last thing before we go, and, you know, as an Arsenal fan, somebody living in Spain, somebody covering football in Spain, how great is it for you to watch Santi Cazorla doing what he's doing at Villarreal?
Oh, it's just been, I mean, it's been incredible. Like, it's not an exaggeration to say that he's been, you know, easily in the top five players in La Liga this season, easily. Mm. And that's not me talking with my Arsenal hat on. That's just anyone would tell you that. Yeah, he's been so, so good. He wears the captain's armband for Villarreal. He's back in the Spain squad again this time. It's just been an absolute delight. I watch all of that with just a tiny little tinge of regret that it came after leaving Arsenal. I think we all understand why he left when he did. You know, the club had stood by him for a long, long time, and it's totally understandable why they let him go when he did. And I don't think anyone really, really expected him. I mean, he said himself, you know, all he wanted to do last season was play. He had no idea if he was even going to be able to play regularly for Villarreal. He did that last year and was very, very good. And this year he's stepped it up and he's been even better again. And like I say, one of the best players in La Liga. So no, it's just been, it's been fantastic to watch here. It really has.
I think the thing, you know, people will look on when any player leaves and he does well somewhere else, is always that, oh, why did we let him go? And like, why can't we bring him back? Those things rage around. But I think you can't overlook the home element of the Santi Cazorla situation, because he'd been 18 months out injured in England. He'd been back in Spain quite a lot for his treatment and his rehabilitation and his surgeries and everything else. But also just the comfort of home and the comfort of, you know, being in his home country, playing at Villarreal again. You know, it feels like if we want to make the analogy to Goldilocks and the Three Bears, the porridge was just right, and without those elements all coming together, maybe it wouldn't be going as well for him.
Yeah, I mean, Villarreal is a lovely place to play football as well. It really, really is. You know, it's a tiny little, almost kind of family club. You know, they shouldn't have anything like the status that they have. But I've been down there, down to the training ground. They've got amazing facilities. You know, it's a lovely part of Spain to live in because the sun's always shining. I think there is a lot to like about playing your football down there, and certainly at this stage of his career. And yeah, he can be the main man there. Like I say, he's the captain, you know, and all of their play kind of goes through him. So yeah, I think the circumstances for him being there are couldn't really be better. And yeah, let's hope it carries on. This kind of Indian summer of his career continues for as long as possible.
Yeah, and now that we can watch Spanish football on TV again, it's going to be good to watch throughout the season. Of course, people can keep up with what's going on in Spain via the Spanish Football Podcast. Alex is the producer. Thank you very much indeed for your time. We'll chat to you again soon, I hope.
It's my pleasure. Anytime.
Thank you very much indeed to Alex. You can find him on Twitter at Alex Kirkland. That is at Alex Kirkland. And Alex is the producer of the Spanish Football Podcast, which I'm sure many of you know. Follow that at @TSF_podcast, @TSF_podcast.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Right, if you are listening to this on Friday, October the 11th, you may or may not be aware that today is International Day for the Girl. And to mark this, Tim Stillman spoke to Arsenal defender Leah Williamson, who was recently in Jakarta with the Arsenal Foundation. You might have seen earlier in the year, Per Mertesacker was out there to take part in the Arsenal Coaching for Life program. Tim talks to Leah about her trip, about the young girls she met out there, the conditions they're growing up in, and how the program is giving them confidence and resilience, as well as some much-needed fun in their lives. She also talks about the recent interview that her teammate Emma Mitchell gave to the BBC about her decision to take time out of last season due to issues with anxiety and mental health. Leah also talks about winning her place in the England starting lineup and looks ahead to Sunday's big game against Chelsea this weekend. The Arsenal women are in action there, and of course the Arsenal women are the reigning FA Women's Super League champions. Champions at Arsenal. This is Tim and Leah. Enjoy.
Leah, let's start at the beginning. We're here to discuss something quite specific today, mainly. A trip you recently took with the Arsenal Foundation. Would you like to describe where you went and for what reason?
Yeah, so I went with the Arsenal Foundation and Save the Children over to Jakarta in Indonesia, where we have the Coaching for Life programme set up. It's pretty special. I felt very privileged actually to be able to go over there and see the work that we're doing. But yeah, the Coaching for Life program, we go over there, we take coaches from North London, and we coach, or we teach their coaches over there to deliver a 20-week program for the girls and boys out there that are part of the program. And yeah, so we train them to be able to deliver it, and then they run the sessions, and they're a lot more, not more so much about football, but more about building resilience, self-confidence, you know, helping the kids to deal with emotions or circumstances. You know, a lot of these children come from very deprived areas, which we saw and went to sort of have a look around. So it's pretty special programme and project.
I was going to ask you that actually. I take it you'd never been to Jakarta or Indonesia before. What did you make of it?
Yeah, hot, completely different. Very busy. It's really, really busy, and I think that was one of the main things that sort of struck me. There's just so many people. The traffic, the houses are built so close together. There's can't get anywhere quickly, and you know, even in the sort of underprivileged areas where the pitches are built, it's sort of narrow streets, mopeds, you know, just flying about. Everybody seems to be going somewhere all the time, basically. So yeah, I feel like for the little that they have, life is very fast paced, and everybody's, you know, trying to sort of, you know, keep going and fighting their circumstances, which, yeah, it made me very grateful for what I have, especially here.
And how did the trip come about? I know you've done like coaching clinics and stuff like that down at the Arsenal Hub, which is next to the stadium.
Yeah.
Did the foundation approach you? Did you express an interest? How did this all get kicked off?
Yeah, so even the times that I've sort of been down to the Hub, I've just either, you know, a couple of the girls from the programme down there had messaged me and said, you know, do you want to come down and see one of our sessions? So, you know, even stuff like that sort of happened quite naturally, but the foundation came to me and sort of said, this is something that potentially we'd like to have you out and go in and having a look. I think I'm a good fit for it, just because of, you know, one of the messages that we try and sort of spread, especially here in the community hub at the stadium and also out there is in Jakarta, is that once you're part of the Arsenal family, you're part of the family forever. There's an enormous support system, and like I say, once you're part of the family, you have access to that. So I think having been here since the age of 9 and having used every single part of that support system and also given back to it, I suppose I was a good fit to sort of go out and it's, you know, instead of just standing in front of those girls out there and saying, oh, I'm a professional footballer, I'm actually living proof of somebody who's come through the system at Arsenal and reaping the full benefits.
And so the girls you met and kind of coached, I guess, what kind of experiences have they gone through? Like, what sort of lives were they leading?
So, yeah, so it's quite, you know, it's hard. It's hard to sort of hear what some of them have been through. We spoke to one girl and she'd lost her mother, you know, sort of trying to grow up without her. Obviously, that was a really sad story. And then you've got a couple of other girls who just sort of fight their way through life and fight for everything that they have. And then one little girl that I met and spent a lot more time with, Dia, she's actually working to support her family, which is just, as a 14-year-old girl, is not something she should ever have to be thinking about. A lot of the girls are forced into child labour, you know, just to support their family, and it's just something that they have to do to get by. And you know, when you compare that to the circumstances in England, and especially what I've been through in my life, it's, you know, you can't even begin to get into their heads.
Yeah, and it's I think it's probably fairly obvious how, like, football can help build confidence, mm-hmm. and things like that, and even in some situations, I suppose, give you a way out. But what I'm quite interested in this is particularly the situation for girls playing football in Jakarta and Indonesia, and what that's like for them, and maybe some of the stereotypes that they face.
Yeah, especially, I say, Dia, the young girl that I spent quite a lot of time with, she said that she even faced, not just from the boys, you know, for playing football, but she also faced, you know, discrimination and sort of a backlash from her friends that were girls. You know, they believe it's quite showy of her to get involved, and she shouldn't be doing that, and she shouldn't be putting herself out there, you know, running around and playing with the boys. So yeah, there's certainly a lot more. You know, maybe the biggest thing I've ever had to worry about in my football career is a parent on the other team disliking the fact that I was better than his kid, you know. And actually these girls are fighting stereotypes just by stepping on the pitch. It's quite incredible. There was quite a nice moment on reflection when we look back, and it was at one point on the second day, I joined in with one of the coaching sessions with the girls, and because of the programme and the normality of it, you know, the programme aims to get 50-50 girls and boys participation, so they really are, you know, saying that this is normal and trying to make that a thing, and all the boys are sitting around the edge of the cage just watching, because it was the girls' time, and the girls, you know, did not bother them at all. So it's quite nice, actually. But especially, like you say, over there in Jakarta, the idea of what a girl should be is certainly not playing football. But then at the same time, it certainly shouldn't be supporting her family and working either. So I think, yeah, the main thing that all the girls have in common is that they just don't care. And they, like I say, just like they fight their way through life, they fight for their right to play on the football pitch.
And what kind of sessions did you put on? What were they like? Or did you partake
Yeah, in? Yeah. So I'm actually a bit of a terrible coach, so I stayed away from that. But I went out with one of the community coaches, Drew, from over here. And most of it is football, you know, and it's fun stuff. You know, it's not meant to be, you know, taxing for the girls. It's not meant to be too difficult, but it's meant to, you know,
Oh, excuse me. I thought it was empty.
Yeah, I think, you know, it's not meant to be taxing for the girls, it's not meant to be too difficult, but it is meant to be engaging and to keep them there. You know, the aim for them is to keep the girls coming back, so all the drills are fun, you know, keeping the girls involved. You know, they want to see them there every week because it means they're having a positive impact on their life and they can sort of monitor them a bit more. But halfway through one of the sessions, it was really nice, so part of the sort of, yeah, the... What do you call it? What do you call it at school? The stimulus?
Part of the programme?
Yeah, part of the programme. Part of the programme is life lessons, basically. So we did an activity where we all stood in a circle and told each other, you know, one after another, rotating round, something that we liked about ourselves. You know, so it's not just about football. It's about, like I say, building the self-confidence, the resilience, teaching you how to deal with your emotions, you know, allowing them to be emotional and giving them that hour of being able to be a kid, which so many of them need so desperately. So yeah, I think that was one of the loveliest things for me. You know, it's football, and then a lot of the girls are, you know, there was a couple that were really, really good, but it's not just about that. It's yeah, it's about more, it's about them as humans and helping them as young girls to sort of fight their way through the you know, past the stereotypes and to allow them to succeed.
And what was your main takeaway from the trip? What do you think's the thing that will always stay with you about it?
I think definitely one of the biggest things that I've learned and like I've brought back here, sort of like I say, on reflection and thinking about how I can help further, you know, because going for 2 days to Indonesia, I've not made a massive impact, but I hope I've had a sort of lasting impact on the girls, and I hope they'll remember it. But for me, coming back here, something that I realised when I was out there is that here people come to football games and I interact with them afterwards and they know who I am and they see the stage that I'm on, and I use that stage hopefully to inspire them and to show them that they can be successful. But it's more, you know, it's really related to football and it's directly sort of related to football. So I think when I went out there, and the fact that they don't know who I am, most of them won't have a clue who I am. They're told who I am, and, you know, naturally they were they were lovely to me and really welcomed me and sort of treat me like almost like a superstar, you know, because they were sort of told to. Actually, when I spoke to Dia and I spent a lot of time with her, the biggest thing for her was my spirit and, you know, how much I've sort of persevered through problems and carried on. And then I sort of realised actually my role as a role model is so much more, and not every girl I meet is going to become a professional footballer, but actually if I can help her just become the most successful version of herself, I think that's pretty special. So I think, yeah, the most long-winded answer ever, but actually I think that's probably the biggest thing I've taken from it, you know, that we could all have an instead of just thinking we have our, I have my strengths and it's playing football and I have a lot more to offer, I think, and we should all sort of try and offer as much as possible. And yeah, if that means I can, like I say, help somebody not just become a footballer but in life, then I suppose that's pretty special.
And that's probably a good segue actually into something else I wanted to ask you about. We're recording this on Thursday, which is actually World Mental Health Day. Mm-hmm. And your teammate Emma Mitchell gave a very candid interview to the BBC about kind of issues she'd had with anxiety last season. I wanted to ask you about how the group feel about that interview. But you know, how first of all, whether you noticed that in Mitch last year, because, you know, she's quite a life and soul person, and you know, kind of, I guess, the impact on the group to see someone that you all care about kind of be vulnerable in this way.
Yeah, I think what I find most worrying, and this is, you know, in the whole world, is that, yeah, I definitely noticed that Mitch was not her usual self. But I didn't at one point think I needed to intervene or try and help. I know obviously we all have the closer people to us and stuff like that. So maybe I wouldn't have been top of the list anyway if I'd have known that somebody needed to step in. But I think that's the problem. You know, we look at people and we think, oh, they're not quite themselves, or maybe there's something wrong. But do we actually ask? Because I didn't, which is definitely something that I've learned from the situation. But like you say, we spend so much time together and everybody cares about each other a lot. So to see Mitch and, you know, be in that vulnerable state, it was a hard thing for the team. But at the same time, I think the beauty of being somewhere like Arsenal, and especially with Joe as manager, it was Mitch first. You know, not one point was there any ever pressure on her to come back. I hope that she never felt like there was, or, you know, to do anything that she wasn't ready to do, because ultimately we wanted to make sure that she was okay before anything else. I think the team, from the point at which Mitchie sort of asked for help or took the option of help, I think the team acted great in terms of you know, bringing her back in, trying to be as normal as possible while also making sure that she had enough support. But I think definitely we were all at fault for, you know, people don't know how to handle it. People don't know how to react, to offer their support without, you know, doing something wrong. So I think the way that she handled it, and especially most of it, you know, would have been on her own at the start and in her own head. I think, you know, I'm so happy that she's found the strength to speak up and tell people. And also, you know, it's an ongoing journey. You know, now that it's not everything's fixed and everything's better. Like I say, she'll have people that she's really close to and people that will be able to get into her head a little bit more than others. But I think the fact that she's now spoken out about it, we all need to be accountable to looking after each other. And yeah, I'm just, it was hard to see, like I say, somebody that you all sort of, you spend so much time together and you really notice things. And especially when she wasn't here, you know, she left a gaping hole in this team, because she is the life and soul of the party. But I almost think that was, you know, that's the worst bit, because maybe we didn't know how to approach her. So I think it's really brave, and I'm really, really happy that she's found the strength to do that for herself, but also to help other people. And, you know, she's still being selfless even now, you know, by spreading the word, I suppose.
And I wanted to talk about you a little bit as well in closing. Actually, on my way here, I imagine that the comments were embargoed from Tuesday night until today, but Phil Neville gave an interview today where he said he felt disappointed in himself for not playing you more at the World Cup. Get in the queue, Phil. And he said he was getting 20 Instagram messages a day about playing you. I only sent about 15 of those. So, but he talked about how he felt like he couldn't not play you anymore. And obviously you've played in both of these games now against Brazil and Portugal. How did that make you feel reading those quotes, where Phil's being quite honest about, you know, he kind of regrets not playing you more in the World Cup, and now saying that he considers you, I don't think he said undroppable, but he doesn't feel like he can leave you out anymore. How did that make you feel?
Yeah, it's nice, you know. I do a job and two people judge me on it, my club manager and my England manager, and ultimately they decide my destiny. So to hear him say that is obviously a nice thing. I wish he'd have realised a little bit sooner if that's how he felt. But no, joking aside, I think I was realistic about my opportunities at the World Cup, so I think I always knew that was going to be the case. But I do think I did bring a certain level, and I think I've continued with that now, so I'm glad that it's getting some recognition, because like I say, I do my job to impress two people, and you know, hopefully I was going to get an opportunity at some point to be able to get these two games under my belt. I could only do what I can do, and hopefully it'll be enough to keep me in and around the team, certainly in the squad, yeah.
And a final question, big game this Sunday, away at Chelsea, a real kind of watermark game last season, in the league anyway, maybe not so much the FA Cup. I really felt watching the Brighton game, I felt that Arsenal had probably played well in spells in a lot of games this season, and those spells were getting bigger and bigger. I feel like Brighton was the first time I really watched Arsenal and thought, this is the Arsenal of last season.
Yeah.
How are the girls feeling ahead of this game on Sunday?
Yeah, I think we know what we're capable of, and we definitely haven't showed that yet. Like, Brighton was a great game for us to finish sort of that period of that first month on, because we had played well. Like you say, we had showed excellence in areas, but that was actually a game where we really dominated, and To get a clean sheet and so many goals, it's a great thing. But I think, yeah, we're confident. We've had a level now, I think, for the last, you know, since this game last year, really, where we've sort of showed that we are here to dominate. And, we don't just want to win games here and there. We want to win all that we can. So, yeah, we're confident, but also we're aware that, you know, last year was a great result for us, and it's not necessarily going to be the same game. But I think we're still capable of bringing home the result. And like I said, I think the best thing is that we know that we've got more to come. So hopefully, you know, that'll keep coming out, and this weekend will be the next step on the ladder in terms of, you know, really seeing what we're capable of.
Well, best of luck for Sunday. Thank you so much for joining us. Great to have, dare I say, an Arsenal legend on the podcast. We had Ian Wright on earlier this week, so you know, two big Arsenal legends on the podcast in 1 week. So thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks.
That was Tim Stillman talking to Leah Williamson. And if you want to follow the Arsenal women in a bit more detail, one, go to Arseblog News and click on the section for women. Tim does amazing stuff there. Two, check out some of the Arsenal women Arsecast episodes that Tim does along with Pippa. There are interviews with the manager, Joe Montemuro, many of the players, and you get such amazing insight into the team and what drives them. And they're so brilliant and so successful at this moment in time. They deserve all the support that they're getting, and if you want to get on board, that's how you find out a bit more about the Arsenal women. Of course, there's stuff on the official Arsenal website as well, and you can find out how to get tickets and go to the games and bring your kids. It's well worth doing. So there you go, Tim and Leia. I hope you enjoy that. That's about it for this episode. Myself and James will be here on Monday. We'll have an Arsecast Extra, an Interlull Arsecast Extra. It's an Arsenal free weekend, so you're going to have to find something else to frustrate you this weekend. I'm sure you'll manage to do that. Thank you as ever for listening. I'll catch you on the next one. Until then, take it easy, folks. Cheers. Bye-bye. I was sitting drinking an old fashioned, despairing at the state of the world when this dame walked into the office. She was a knockout with legs like a giraffe, cloven footed and four of them. "What do you want, lady?" I said. "I'm kinda busy here." "Look, mister," she said, "I need your help." "What kind of help?" I said. "Well," she said, "somebody's selling stories about me to the papers. They got info that they shouldn't have. Basically," she said, "there's a mole, and I need you to find out who the rat is." I paused for a moment. "What exactly are you looking for here, lady? You want me to find a mole, or you want me to find a rat?" "I don't know," she said. "It could be a weasel or a stool pigeon. Who am I to know?" "That's why you're the PI, isn't it?" "Yeah, lady," I said, taking a sip of my drink. "I'm a PI, not a goddamn pet store."
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.